The best advice you can get from the President of the United States.
Keep your hands washed. Cover your mouth when you cough. Stay home from work if you're sick, and keep your children home from school if they're sick.
Chrysler's going bankrupt, the economy shrinking, wars rage on in Afghanistan and Iraq, and now President Obama is trying to keep swine flu at bay. Today on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, April the 30th. I'm Femi OK. John Hockenberry is away, but Takeaway BFF Todd Zwillick is here. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Femi. Coming up this hour, we'll examine President Obama's press conference last night. He talked about swine flu and a lot more. Also, New Orleans Jazz Festival is underway. Plenty of music, but we're going to talk about what you can eat.
Oh, yes.
How do you make the perfect gumbo? Mm. And we'll look into how local governments are working to combat the swine flu virus. Those stories are coming up. But first, these headlines.
Mexico is taking major precautions to stop the spread of the H1N1 swine flu virus. President Felipe Calderon is advising Mexicans to remain indoors between the 1st and the 5th of May. Keep in mind that Mexico's population size comes in at 107 million people, and that's a large number of people to keep cooped up inside. And there are 2,500 suspected cases of swine flu in Mexico and more than 160 suspected deaths. The U.S. government is making preparations as well. 140 schools are closing in Fort Worth, Texas, which affects tens of thousands of students. And some schools are closing in 9 other states as well. And meanwhile, the government is asking employers to prepare contingency plans for workers in case they need to telecommute. 91 cases have been confirmed in the U.S., Todd.
Femi, it's April 30th, which is the government-imposed deadline for Chrysler to make a deal with Italian carmaker Fiat. President Obama says the goal is to get Chrysler off of the government's books.
I would love to get the U.S. government out of the auto business as quickly as possible.
The plan doesn't look likely, though, since talks between Chrysler's creditors, Fiat, and the Treasury fell through last night. Unless a swift deal comes through, Chrysler is expected to file for bankruptcy today. Bank of America shareholders have removed Ken Lewis from his post as chairman. He's come under fire recently for paying too much money in the bank's takeover of Merrill Lynch. Merrill's losses caused the bank to seek a second round of bailout from Washington. He'll stay on as CEO, however. Yesterday, Congress gave the okay to President Obama's 2010 budget. It comes in at a whopping $3.5 trillion. Very few Republicans, if any, voted for it, Femi.
We have some key economic indicators out later this hour, so we'll keep an eye on that for the latest unemployment claims and personal income and outlays. The Dow and S&P both closed up more than 2% yesterday. The Dow kicks off at 81.86. The S&P starts trade at 874. Later in the program, we'll be looking at employers who are hiring. But what's your tip for job hunting that can give the unemployed a leg up?
Oh.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can help that person who's just become unemployed.
A beep.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, joined across the table by Femi. Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
President Barack Obama marked his first 100 days in office last night with his primetime news conference. It was the third of his presidency and the first that was not dominated by the recession.
The typical president, I think, has two or three big problems. We've got seven or eight big problems.
All right. Well, the president talked about at least 7 or 8 of those problems last night. I was there in the East Room proudly representing the takeaway last night.
I saw you.
Yes. And we're joined by 2 other reporters who were there in the East Room with the president. April Ryan is White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks. And Julie Mason is White House correspondent for The Washington Examiner. They're both on the line with us. April, I thought the president was very relaxed last night. But what did you think of the atmosphere there? And what did you think of the president's spin on his first 100 days?
I think it was a very good event. I have to chalk it up to them. They really did a good job, and the president was very relaxed. I think the room was crowded.
Sure was.
To say the least. Yes. Reporters were just swarming around just to hear the words of the president to cap off his first 100 days. I think the White House was very delighted. Matter of fact, I know they were because I talked to, by email, Robert Gibbs after the event. So they were well pleased.
They were well pleased. Well, Julie, the president fielded questions about Pakistan, about terrorism, swine flu, the economy, even abortion, which doesn't come up too often these days. But he was also asked point blank if the Bush administration before him had sanctioned torture by allowing waterboarding. Listen to this, if you would.
Did the previous administration sanction torture?
I believe that waterboarding was torture. And I think that the whatever legal rationales were used, it was a mistake.
All right, Julie Willett. President got pressed on that issue. Is waterboarding torture, and did the previous administration sanction torture? It was a pointed moment. What did you think of that?
It was an interesting moment, Todd. The president has really avoided directly criticizing his predecessor. He criticizes their policies and their thinking on things, but he never came out and said, yes, the former administration tortured. He said, well, waterboarding is torture, and they waterboarded, and their justifications were not great for it. So it was a very interesting moment. He was on the spot. He handled it very, very carefully.
Well, does it change the policy at all? You know, last week, of course, there was a lot of news. We all wrote about it and talked about it. The president said that operatives who were following legal advice from the Justice Department would not be prosecuted then. We wrote that he left the door open to Justice Department officials who had crafted the policy that they could possibly be prosecuted if the Attorney mm-hmm. General thinks it's fit. Does the president saying in his own words it was torture, it was illegal, does that change the White House's policy posture at all?
No, I don't think so. I think what it does is it does not diminish the pressure from some in the Democratic Party, especially the liberal wing, the pressure on the White House to actually go back and prosecute some of the operators from the prior administration. I mean, they've tried to quell that. They've tried to release the torture memos and then move on. But some in the president's own party don't want him to do that.
Right. Well, April, the president spent a fair amount of time in his opening remarks and in response to a couple of questions talking about H1N1, also known as the swine flu. He urged people, of course, to wash their hands, urged people to consider keeping their kids home from school and staying home from work. Do you think that the president was appropriately cautious and comforting? What did you think of the tone that he struck on that issue?
He gave very basic practices for people to take. Like you said, wash their hands, stay home. And he wanted to make the point because some kind of chuckled when he said that. He said, look, this might be basic, but this is what we have to do. And, you know, the reporter also, the first question that came out from a reporter, Jen Lovin of AP, she even asked if the Mexican border should be closed right now.
Right. And at that point, he said that there's really no point.
Right. And it's like letting the horse out of the barn and then shutting the door, you know, because he said we already have cases now. So, you know, we have to just monitor. And he's basically saying, look, we have the capability to control this. We have to take care of it. This is our responsibility to watch and to do what we have to do, washing our hands, staying at home, being responsible. And this could help fix the situation instead of closing the border. And he's carried it like he's carried many other things, very confident, strong. That's at least what he relayed to the American public. And the American public at this time seems to be very concerned. It almost is likened to when people were scared and wrapping their houses with plastic sheeting.
Plastic.
Right. Oh, back in the yeah. – that was in the Tom Ridge days, wasn't it?
Right. Yes.
When they first came out with the color-coded terrorism code strategy.
Yes.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Julie, you were interested, I think, in the question on immigration and how the president dealt with the issue of immigration reform. And I want to play something for you real quick before I get you to respond to this. This is a question that was asked about immigration and immigration reform strategy by Lori Montenegro from Univision. She asked the president a question about immigration. Here's how he answered it.
If the American people don't feel like you can secure the borders, then it's hard to strike a deal that would get people out of the shadows and on a pathway to citizenship who are already here, because the attitude of the average American is going to be, well, you're just going to have hundreds of thousands of more coming in each year.
Well, Julie, immigration reform, the president was asked specifically if that policy is going to get done this year. He kind of batted it away, didn't he?
He did, Todd. It's real interesting because it was less than a year ago the president spoke to the League of United Latin American Citizens and promised them that immigration reform was going to be, quote, a top priority, end quote, of his first term. We have not heard really much about immigration at all. The president had a pretty good explanation. He said, you know, I got a lot going on. I got too much to do, and we're just going to have to put that off. So that was his response. But at the same time, you know, immigration is a huge fight. It's a huge battle. A battle they don't need right now. So that's I would say that's a promise broken by him.
All right. April, Julie, the three of us have something in common, probably more than one thing, but we have something in common from last night. None of us got called on to ask a question last night. So
that's a great club.
So
that's a large amount.
Yeah. It's a bit of a sad club, but it's our club nonetheless. So just real quick, April, what was your top question? What would you have asked?
Okay, I have about seven questions.
Start with one, because we want to get around the horn here real quick, and I think Femi has an important question, too.
Right. The top question I wanted to ask, East Africa is being thought of by many of the U.S. military officials now as becoming the new Afghanistan, as extremists are moving from the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. And what concrete steps were you going to make or are planning or working on right now to fix that situation?
Yeah. Julie? Hmm.
My question was about, Obama likes the word imprimatur. And so he's put that upon Afghanistan and the economy now, two problems he inherited from the prior administration. And my question was, when does the economy become Obama's economy? When can we start expecting some solid results from him? When does he claim that as his own? And also Afghanistan, which is now his war. At what point does that become his problem and no longer the creation of the prior administration?
Right. Well, I would have asked, you know, the president criticized the last administration for letting political motivations judge who is prosecuted and directing the Justice Department on whom to prosecute and who not to prosecute. Was it appropriate, Mr. President, for you to say intelligence officials, operatives won't be prosecuted? Should the president of the United States ever say who will be prosecuted and not? Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's what I would ask.
And would you have done it in that exact tone of voice?
Exact.
It was very commanding, very masterful. Question to April. April, as you were in the room, it's a very different atmosphere from being in the room as to watching it at home on TV. What area do you think the president looked most uncomfortable about answering?
I think he went back, the back and forth about the waterboarding. And not just that, it was another question.
I think most of all he was very comfortable in his
answers and how he relayed his concerns or his confidence to the public. But when he came back to the issue of waterboarding and they had to ask him again, you know, what did you think of the Bush administration's efforts with waterboarding? He said, whatever legal rationales used were a mistake. That was big news. Mm. That was big news.
And Julie, you noticed an answer he gave about African Americans and the economy real quickly.
Right. He was asked about how the economic problems for Black America are so much worse than for everyone else. And he seemed a little uncomfortable, and he gave a very short shrift and moved right on.
All right, guys. Well, it was nice seeing you there last night. Thanks, as always, for joining us. April Ryan is White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks. Julie Mason is a White House correspondent for The Washington Examiner, two favorite journalists of mine. Thanks for joining us, guys. Well, this morning we want to know, as the economy contracts and people are looking for jobs, there are still jobs out there. What are your job-seeking tips? Have you had some success in finding a job? Have your friends had some success using some kind of tactic or a strategy that was maybe novel? Did they stay out of the classifieds and use the people they know?
Yeah.
We want to know how they did it and how you did it. Give us a call, 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Todd Zwillick here, sitting across from Femi Okeh this morning. Millions of people out there, 5 million people, Femi, have lost their jobs in this recession. Mm-hmm. And in this day and age and in this economy, it's getting harder and harder to find a job. And people are looking. So they need your help. We want listeners' help. We want their collective wisdom. We want to hear from them about tips they have that they've given their friends or they themselves in job hunting. What can give them a leg up?
This is Tyrone from Baltimore. As far as networking and getting JLB business cards, be they real or phony, post it wherever you can. And network hard.
Network hard. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi.
So if I wasn't sitting in the studio here with Todd this morning, I would be in New Orleans partying.
You make it sound like I'm preventing you from having a good time.
Oh, you so are. This week is the famous annual New Orleans Jazz Festival. And of course, most people go to the Jazz Festival to hear the music, get away from Todd. But the festival isn't just a celebration of music. It's a celebration of food. There's some amazing dishes that you might never find anywhere outside of Louisiana. Kathy Gunst is a freelance food writer and a radio producer. She's been at the Jazz Festival taking a look at all that food. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning.
So first of all, tell us, what are the sort of things that you discovered at the Jazz Festival is that people come for the music, but they also come for the food in particular?
Oh, absolutely. There's an incredible variety of food there, and not just the obvious things like jambalaya and barbecue. This is the best of the best. There's a juried group of food vendors there. In other words, you have to be the best andouille sausage maker. You have to make the best soft-shell crab po' boys. It's not just your normal, you know, festival food, hot dogs and burgers. In fact, you don't even see those there.
And the way people talk about food, you can actually imagine it. Have a listen to Andrea Taylor.
I had crawfish Monica, which is crawfish and a pasta, and it is so good. What are we going to get? The jambalaya. There's a gumbo that's real good. I had a white chocolate sauce bread pudding, and it was delicious. It's the all-day affair. You got to take your time, though. If you eat too fast, you get sick. So you got to eat some, let it go down, do a little dancing, then eat some more.
Yeah, I can picture Andrea dancing and eating there. Of course, there's New Orleans, and then you always think of gumbo. But that's too obvious, isn't it, Kathy? There's so much more.
There is so much more. In fact, what do you think the official state food is? You probably are going to guess it's something like gumbo, but you'd be wrong. It's actually a dish from the northern city of Natchitoches, Louisiana, and it's a meat pie. And I met a woman named Linda Wheat. She's been selling these meat pies at the Jazz Fest for 30 years, and they're like a pocket pie with an incredibly flaky, crisp crust, and it's filled with ground beef and three types of peppers, garlic and onions, and a lot of spices.
Let's check out Linda.
Natchitoches had several plantations, and these were pies that were made by the slaves. And they would use the leftovers from the kitchen in the big house and bring them home and make them for their family, or it actually developed into something they sold on the streets in Natchitoches.
As you talk to people about food at the Jazz Festival, we're also learning history as well. Tell me about the discovery you made about soldiers from the Second World War, or from the Korean War, I should say, and food that they brought back.
This was fascinating. I met Ms. Linda. Ms. Linda is the Yakamain lady, and she talked to me about this dish that was brought to New Orleans by the black soldiers who served in the Korean War. They brought it home with them, and it is called Yakamain. And up until recently, it was really only known in the black community. But Linda Green, Ms. Linda, she wants to really introduce this to a wider audience.
It's noodles, green onions, meat, hard-boiled egg, and the broth. The broth is the yakka. They call it old soul, but that's what the Korean soldiers used to do. They would be out there fighting, and they start making yakka meat, and they drinking and having a good time, and they get some yakka meat, and it sobers them up.
Kathy, Yakamain, she said meat, but she wasn't specific. Is it yak?
No, it's not okay. Yak at all. It can be any kind of meat. She uses beef. She uses pork. She even had a vegetarian version. And let me tell you, there were a lot of people at this jazz fest that needed some of that stuff to sober them up. A lot of partying, a lot of good music.
Kathy, we're almost out of time, but we've always got space for dessert. So tell us about a special kind of dessert that you found when you were doing your research.
Well, you find all the kind of things you might expect, like strawberry shortcake on a Creole tart and key lime tarts and banana bread pudding. But Chris Williams, she grew up in New Iberia, Louisiana, and she's been involved with Jazz Fest for about 28 years. She introduced me to a frozen treat I had never heard of.
This is called a huckabuck, and it's frozen, sugary, Kool-Aid-y kind of, almost like an Italian ice, but it's a New Orleans ice. It's sold in the neighborhoods. Usually there's somebody's grandma in the background selling them to the kids. And it's something that all the Creoles and blacks of New Orleans grew up with.
Kathy Guntz, when you started out doing your research and collecting all that sound, how much did you weigh?
Wouldn't you like to know?
How much do you weigh now?
There, yeah. My husband's taken to calling me Rubenesque.
Oh, yes, that's a great way to be. Thank you for sharing the calories with us this morning. Kathy Guntz, food writer and radio producer, bringing us the tastes and the food of the New Orleans Jazz Festival. Now that we're all hungry, Richard Hake is here with the headlines.
To disgust you, actually, because we're going to talk about flu. I'm sorry. There are nearly 2,500 suspected cases of swine flu in Mexico. Mexican President Felipe Calderon is asking the 107 million citizens to stay inside for the next 5 days, from May 1st through May 5th. And, of course, May 5th is Cinco de Mayo, a national holiday in Mexico. Vice President Biden was on CBS earlier this morning. He said Americans should stay calm for now.
The best thing to do is for us to act, as the president said now, in a rational way. We're on top of this thing. We should be mitigating the prospects of it spreading. And the way to do that is to deal with all the things you know about as a mother.
And this, of course, what President Obama said last night. He stressed that people should be washing their hands often. And the World Health Organization upgraded its international alert to level 5. That's one shy of a pandemic. A level 5 alert means that the virus has spread from human to human in at least 2 countries. On Capitol Hill, Congress approved the president's 2010 budget plans to the tune of $3.5 trillion. And today, Congress takes on 2 bills that could help consumers. The House votes on a bill that would limit the power credit card companies have to unexpectedly raise your rates. It's expected to pass. But the Senate will have a tough vote on a bill that would give mortgage relief to homeowners. In Pakistan, a series of gun attacks in the southern city of Karachi killed at least 26 people. The Pakistani military has been battling Taliban militants along the northern border. The president says the country there is starting to take militant threats more seriously and realizing that its focus shouldn't be on terrorists coming from India.
Richard Hake, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
John Hockenberry is off today, so it's Femi Oke and Todd Zwillick looking after you. Later on in the program, we'll be talking about employers who are hiring. So we wanted to know, for the many millions of people who are out of work, what tips do you have for job hunting that can give them a leg up?
Mary from Wyandotte, Michigan. I recommend people strive to create their own work. They can create their own jobs.
Call us 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
All right, thanks, Femi. 91 confirmed cases of H1N1 so far in the United States, according to the CDC this morning. Nearly 2,500 cases south of the border in Mexico. So far, swine flu is still not an outbreak. It is an outbreak, forgive me, not a pandemic, not technically. Global health officials are warning that it could soon turn into a pandemic. The virus is now in at least 10 countries, and yesterday the WHO raised the global pandemic level to phase 5 out of 6. So how prepared are we here in the United States? A lot of our public health infrastructure response to outbreaks like this are at the state and local level. The government oversees it at the federal level, but when someone comes to take care of you or to address a pandemic or an outbreak in your community, it's usually your state and local health officials. Well, Dr. Paul Jarrus is executive director of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. He joins us from D.C. right now. He's the guy who represents all the state and county health departments that respond to outbreaks like this on the front lines. Dr. Jarrus, I want you to listen to something from the president's news conference last night as he addressed money that he's trying to get out of Congress to help local health departments.
I've requested an immediate $1.5 billion in emergency funding from Congress to support our ability to monitor and track this virus and to build our supply of antiviral drugs and other equipment. And we will also ensure that those materials get to where they need to be as quickly as possible.
Dr. Jarrus, $1.5 billion, what is it going to go for?
Well, I think the important thing to hear the president saying is $1.5 billion immediately. We do need that money immediately to jumpstart the response. Public health community at the state, local, and federal level has been preparing for years for a pandemic. We are well prepared. We have plans. They've been exercised. They've been drilled. And right now they're being put in place across the country. But we know that as this thing escalates, which we believe it will, as we see on a day-to-day basis, that we're going to need reinforcements. We're going to need financial reinforcements to escalate the response and keep it moving vigorously. Now, so what the president is saying, clearly we will need money to continue to support a public health workforce that's 24/7 at this point. We'll also need additional antivirals. We'll need additional masks, gowns, and other things to support the response and protect the public.
And now, often public health functions are the first thing to go in a bad economy or when states cut budgets. I was in the subcommittee the other day in the Senate in front of a Tom Harkin subcommittee when you testified along with Tony Fauci and CDC officials. You said that a lot of local health departments have less workers now than they did even 2-3 years ago. Is that true?
We've been looking at this very hard, in fact, cooperating with our counterparts at the local and county level. We represent the state level, and we our estimates, when we have a couple PhD researchers looking at this, that currently we have approximately 10,000, slightly more than 10,000 job losses in public health at the state and local level over the past year. And we anticipate this to continue, given the state of the budgets that we're facing at the local and state level. So, yes, we have less workers than we had even a year ago.
Can the money that the president is requesting go directly to hiring and hiring skilled people?
That is our hope, our wish, and as you heard in the testimony, what we are testifying to request from the Congress and the president. The president's request actually is a one-page letter to Congresswoman Pelosi, and doesn't specify precisely how the money goes. So he has left that open for Congress to determine the best way to use the money.
Okay, now, Dr. Jarrus, healthcare in this country, as I know that you know, is notoriously variable. The quality, the access varies from state to state, locality to locality. Is it the same in public health? Do we see local public health infrastructure that's really, really good in one state but really poor in another? And if so, what does that mean if H1N1 starts to spread countrywide?
Well, our goal, of course, is to assure that every American or everyone living in this country, no matter where they live, has access to public health. And just as we argue all the time that we should have universal health care benefits in this nation, we believe we should have universal public health coverage, and we hope that is part of health reform.
But is it very variable right now?
It is variable right now, and the structural variability does not necessarily mean the service varies. I'll give you an example. The first outbreaks here in California were in San Diego and Imperial County. There are local health departments in San Diego and Imperial County. There is, of course, the state health department that coordinates the local health departments. Texas, however, it was Bexar County, where there is no local health department. However, the state provides the local services there. So it's a mixed system where in 27 states, the state is both part of the some of the local care and the state care. So it's a system of overlapping systems. The important thing is that the federal, state, and local systems line up as one system.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Jarrett, before I let you go, there's one thing the president said last night at his news conference that bears repeating over and over, and I want you to react to it if you'd listen to this.
Keep your hands washed. Cover your mouth when you cough. Stay home from work if you're sick, and keep your children home from school if they're sick.
You want to react to that, Dr. Jarrett?
He is absolutely right, and he gets a blue ribbon from public health. I was actually amazed at how fluent the president was on this issue last night, how well he spoke about it and well he understood it, and that's a real testament to those who are briefing him and to the president himself. Absolutely. The first person to rely upon is yourself. The people you first need to rely upon is your family. So washing your hands. If you're sneezing or coughing, do it into a Kleenex. Throw that Kleenex out and wash your hands. If you don't have a Kleenex, cough into your elbow. Frequent hand washing is very important. And, you know, for at least 20 seconds. So if you have kids, as NPR reported yesterday, have them sing the alphabet as they're washing their hands. That's about 20 seconds.
All right. Wash your hands. Wash your hands. The message is wash your hands. Have I stressed that enough? Dr. Paul Jarrett, the executive director of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, thank you for joining us from Washington. We appreciate it. Wash your hands.
Oh, please.
It's very, very important. I'm not ashamed to say it. All right. Richard has washed his hands. Richard Hake is
several times.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. He's here with headlines.
That's because 140 schools are closed in the Texas area today as the government tries to stop the spread of the swine flu. President Obama says the government is prepared to deal with the crisis.
Everyone should rest assured that this government is prepared to do whatever it takes to control the impact of this virus.
The CDC confirmed 91 cases in the U.S. Already the government has released 12 million doses of Tamiflu from the federal stockpile. In Mexico, there are nearly 2,500 suspected cases. In other news, Defense Secretary Robert Gates is asking Congress to pass an $83 billion spending bill for operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. He says the Pentagon needs the money before Memorial Day. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says combat patrols in Basra will end as British troops prepare to leave the country. He made the announcement today after meeting with the Iraqi Prime Minister in London. And the latest jobless claim figures are in. There's good news. The Labor Department says the number of new applications for unemployment insurance fell to 631,000 last week.
Oh, thank you, Richard. Glimmer of good news on the job front. Nice to hear.
And we are talking about unemployment today. We're talking about your tips for the unemployed. Send them to us, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Femi Okay. This week, we are marking our one-year anniversary on the air by checking in with people who have really been the backbone of the show. Janie Larson is someone who made the enormous consequences of the economic downturn extremely real and accessible. Now, she lives in a suburb of Columbus, Ohio, and is raising her two grandchildren there, aged 5 and 6. And when we spoke to Janie last May, gas was skyrocketing, food prices were climbing, and Janie had to somehow hold her life together for her and her grandkids.
I'm terrified. I don't sleep at night. I'm scared for my grandkids. What are we looking at? And I'm not going to be the only one in this situation, I understand. And I feel sorry for the ones who are worse off than I, but it's terrifying.
Janie, thanks for coming back. Good morning. How are things today?
Good morning. Well, today was supposed to be my new move-out day from the sheriff. He ticketed my home, and I called him the day before yesterday and said I needed a few more days, and he was very nasty, but he agreed to let me move little by little till Wednesday because I can't get movers, and I have to work during the week, so I don't know. And I have to take my dog to the pound on Saturday, and I'm just, it's kind of weepy for me. But, you know, we're heading onward into a new world, and I rented a place, and I'm going to be rooming with someone so we can share expenses because she's, you know, wanting to cut back on her expenditures, too. So it's going to be a whole new ball game for me after 38 years in this house. I'm just, you know, kind of sad.
You've got a little five-year-old and a six-year-old, and kids that age are so joyful and such a pleasure to be around. How do you contrast what's going on in your real life with having to bring up the grandkids?
Well, I'm tired, and they're a lot of work, but I love them dearly, and I'm all they got. I think that this isn't fair to them. They deserve someone with young and, you know, money to go places and do things. But they don't, you know, materialistic things don't really mean too much to us. We have more fun just, you know, going to the Dairy Queen or, you know, playing t-ball outside. Or I had them in a little soccer league, the neighborhood soccer league, so they enjoy that. But I just don't want to – I find myself – angry at times, and I don't want to put that on them. You know, I don't want them to have to deal with this. But I made, you know, they were sad at first, and they're sad that we have to get rid of the dog. But, you know, I got them a goldfish.
So,
trying to compensate here. But, you know, this isn't forever, and then I have to keep my focus on that. This isn't forever. I'm taking life in 24-hour increments. I do have my joy, and they are part of my joy, and I have three other grandkids, and, you know, it can get better tomorrow. Just as fast as it got bad, it can get better again.
Janie, we came back to you because you had such an amazing outlook on life. You were a little element of the recession and tough times, but you made us smile and cry at the same time. We will check back in with you. Give our love to your grandkids and good luck with your move.
Thank you so much, and take care of yourself.
Thank you very much. That's Janie Larson, one of our very special takeaway guests from a year ago. She's from Columbus, Ohio. She is moving out of her foreclosed home this weekend. So during these tough economic times, we are asking you your tips for finding a job. You can go to the classifieds, you can go to the internet, but do you have any better ideas? 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You're listening to The Takeaway with Femi OK and Todd Swillick.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
John Hockenberry is off today, so is Femi OK and Todd Swillick taking care of you. This morning we've been asking for your help. In a little while we'll be talking about employers who are employing people. But what's your tip for the millions of people who are still looking for a job? What's your own tip for helping people find employment?
Yeah, good morning. This is Willie from New Bedford. And if you're looking for a job, nepotism. Nepotism always works.
We love that. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or you can send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. We'll be talking more about those job tips in just a moment. Richard Hake, though, you have the latest headlines.
And Femi, good morning. To update you on the flu, Mexico is sharply restricting public gatherings and commercial activities in an attempt to slow down the swine flu. President Felipe Calderon asked millions of people to stay indoors until the 5th of May. Congress has given the thumbs up to President Obama's 2010 budget. It comes in at $3.5 trillion. Also, Congress considers two bills today that may provide relief from the recession to consumers. The House will vote on a measure that would check the power of credit card companies, eliminating sudden rate hikes and late fees. That's expected to pass. But the fate of a bill that would provide mortgage relief to homeowners doesn't seem as certain. It faces a tough vote in the Senate today. A coalition of women's activist groups in Kenya say its members will now, get this, withhold sex from their partners for a week to protest infighting within the national unity government. Here's Patricia Nyawandi of the group Federation of Kenyan Women Lawyers.
We need to wake up the country so that they can all realize that we are in a mess, and what we need to do is really focus on this. So we have said we don't want any distractions, including sex.
Some organizations say they even plan to pay prostitutes to join this strike. Relations between Kenya's coalition government partners have become increasingly testy of late. The women groups say they want to avoid the civil violence that followed the 2007 elections. Also, I know you guys are going to talk about this, but some new economic numbers just out this morning. The government says consumer spending fell by 2.2% in March, the first drop in 3 months. Meanwhile, income growth slipped 0.3%, which is worse than analysts expected.
All right, Richard. Well, thank you. This economy, of course, has shed 5 million jobs since the economic downturn started. 20 minutes ago, there was some good news and some bad news coming from the government. The number of people laid off and filing for unemployment this week actually dipped by 14,000 from the week before to 631,000, but the number of people continuing to claim unemployment went up past 6.3 million people, which is more than economists expected. Remember when getting a job was just a matter of getting your foot in the door? Well, now it seems like some of those doors aren't even there anymore to get your foot jammed into. Well, believe it or not, though, there is some good news out there, and there are still some growth industries, and we want to find out how to exploit them. We're here now with Marcy Albaher. She writes the blog Working the New Economy on Yahoo. Marcy, I want you to listen to this clip about someone who's hiring.
So we started this year with a little over 100 people. We currently have about 140 employees, and we have about 30 open positions right now.
All right, that's Brian Weisfeld. He's Chief Operating Officer of Coupons.com. Marcy, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Brian Weisfeld from Coupons.com says he's hiring, so some fields like coupons are booming, right?
Well, I think coupons.com is an interesting story because it kind of sits at the intersection of two trends, one we all know about, which is the trouble of print media, newspapers, which is where coupons used to be distributed most commonly, and the other is that people want to bargain. So that just showed me, when I found Coupons was hiring, it showed me maybe we need to be reading the news like journalists do all the time to try to understand the trends and then figure out where the jobs might be related to those trends.
Okay, so Coupons, do you have a top three or a top four of industries that are hiring right now that people might want to look towards?
According to a recent survey by the Lucas Group, it's accounting and finance, manufacturing, advertising and marketing, and I did see a lot in advertising and marketing, oddly.
Even though people don't have money to spend.
I know, oddly, and even public relations, I saw a lot. Medical, all health-related industries,
right.
And especially anything that has to do with the aging.
Right. So why are these industries hiring? I mean, it's counterintuitive advertising. You think people don't have money to spend, but is that just because people are desperate to sell, so they're advertising more aggressively and there's opportunities there for people?
You know, it could be, but it also could be that there are just, you know, there are cyclical things happening here, and there are areas like, you know, bargain shopping, like, you know, areas where people do want to spend money these days, where people need help. The job sector, for example.
All right. Well, we have some tape here from a listener who heads a professional organization. He says that joining a professional organization is a great idea. Listen to this.
This is Carol. I'm calling from Red Bank, New Jersey. I'm president of the New Jersey chapter of the Society for Technical Communication. And my suggestion is to find whatever professional society your profession is part of and just join them. It may be expensive, but it's well worth it.
Okay, I think I just called her he. Anyway, I correct myself, that's she. But anyway, what do you think of the advice?
Good idea, especially if you can afford it. There are also ways to get involved in professional associations, especially online, through LinkedIn groups and things that are free that can get you connecting with people in your own profession. But I think what we're going to see is, I laughed at that comment that said nepotism is the best way to find a job. I think the new nepotism is really getting to know those people in your field, making friends in your field. More and more we're going to see that people are getting hired by their peers, by their friends. So who you know is going to be increasingly important.
who you know and whom you call, whom you email. I mean, it pays to be
whom you hang out with.
Downright aggressive, doesn't it?
Whom you sit and have a beer with when you're talking about this crazy economy.
Who you have a beer with. And some people are a little ashamed to just get on the phone and call up their friends and email their friends and say, I'm looking, what do you got? Even people who aren't friends but acquaintances, you have to be aggressive.
In this era, I don't even think you have to be aggressive. You have to be smart. In this era, there is no shame to being looking. Even people who have jobs are looking and have their radar up.
All right. Well, so you mentioned healthcare. You mentioned advertising, coupons, of course. Over the next year, how do we pick out which industries are hiring and which are not? Sort of looking forward, I know you're not an economic forecaster, but I wonder if you have your eyes on anything looking forward that might be growth areas.
I mean, this may seem a little self-serving, but I will tell you the job coaching, preparation, outsourcing, like anything that has to do with placing people in new jobs and helping people navigate this new economy, I'm seeing a lot of growth there. Right. And I'm urging people to read the news, see what's going on. When you see something in the headlines, see if there's something you can look beneath it. I mean, I was thinking today, you know, I would be working for one of those hand sanitizer manufacturers with this swine flu going on. You know, really think about what's happening in the news and what could that mean for different sectors.
All right. Well, some people, you know, we say network, call your friends, hang out with people. A lot of people, I know people in my family who read the paper newspaper. I'm glad there's still some people out there who read papers, but they thumb the classified. So if you're a person who just, that's your know-how, that's what you know how to do, you're comfortable with that, that's your comfort zone and you're thumbing the classifieds, what's the best way to go about it? If you're going to do the old way of sending a resume and a cover letter, millions of people still do that. So what's the best way to go about it?
All right. If you're going to do that, my advice is don't just do that. So if you're going to do that, first of all, you have to have a really buttoned up package. You have to make sure that your resume and cover letter are completely tailored to that job, that the cover letter is always very customized, that you've done research on the company. But try to go one step further. You know that 6 degrees of separation rule? Why don't you look at that company and see, is there anyone you know who knows anyone at that company? If you could get a leg up and get your resume sitting on top, get an introduction, in addition to the cold sending it in, see if there's some way that you could get a recommendation from within that company. Use tools like LinkedIn to see how many degrees away you are from somebody who works there. Don't just do the blank sending it in, because many people will be sending it in with that extra.
You want to stand out from the pack.
Exactly.
So, Marcy, you went through at the beginning of the segment a whole list of employers who are actually hiring. Where did you find them? Because listeners looking for work would be thinking, where does Marcy get that list? Where did she get those leads?
Right. So what I do when I'm looking for stories like this is I'm all over the social networks and Twitter and Facebook, and I actually put out requests to that I'm working on a story. I'm looking for people or finding jobs. And the good news is that I found them. I was bombarded by over 100 emails over the course of 2 days of people telling me about their industry being hired. And a lot of it was kind of their industry expanding, and a lot of it was very similar to this. I talked to a nonprofit that was hiring, and the reason they were hiring is because volunteerism is up right now. So they needed a volunteer coordinator. So there is always that link back to try to figure out why a certain industry is hiring.
All right. Well, it's all about being aggressive, in some cases being a little intuitive, maybe a little bit shameless, and not being afraid to get in touch with your friends and your relatives and anyone you know who might know someone who might know someone who has a job in your community. Marcy Albaher was here with great advice. She writes the blog Working the New Economy on Yahoo. Marcy, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks for coming down and talking to us.
So what's your advice to help somebody who is unemployed and looking for a job?
My advice is to suffer the indignity of a job beneath your station. Preserving dignity in this job market is terribly difficult.
Give other job hunters your tips at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email them to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're also keeping track of swine flu around the nation, and the CDC is saying that America has 91 laboratory confirmed cases and one death. We will continue to follow that story on The Takeaway. Now, if you missed anything from this hour's show and you want to catch up, then you can take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Todd Zwillick.
I'm Femi OK. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Wednesday night, and you can't just get away from reality TV.
The typical president, I think, has two or three big problems. We've got seven or eight big problems.
One atypical president with a supersized serving of problems to go, bringing prime time to breakfast. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, April the 30th. I'm Femi OK. John Hockenberry is away, but I'm joined by The Takeaway's idyllic Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Femi. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about President Obama's press conference from last night, his third in his first 100 days. We'll also take a look at internet piracy and the laws that being passed around the world that would try to stop it. We'll also talk about the spread of swine flu and how we might predict virus outbreaks before they happen in the future. Those stories coming up. But first, these headlines.
The number of schools closing in the U.S. over concerns about the H1N1 swine flu virus is climbing. 140 are closing in Fort Worth, Texas, which affects tens of thousands of students. President Obama is asking the public to be prepared for the possibility of more closures.
If more schools are forced to close, we've recommended that both parents and businesses think about contingency plans if their children do have to stay home.
91 cases have been confirmed in the U.S. in 11 states, and over half of those cases are in New York State. We've been talking about President Obama's press conference this morning, but Mexican President Felipe Calderon spent some time before cameras last night as well.
El lunes pasado, el lunes 27,
Last Monday, I suspended classes in all of the country's schools. Now we're extending this measure. Non-essential government activities will be suspended.
President Calderon is also advising all Mexicans to stay indoors between the 1st and 5th of May. And that really means 107 million people. There are 2,500 suspected cases of swine flu in Mexico and more than 160 suspected deaths, Todd.
Femi, some new economic indicators just out. The government says consumer spending fell by 0.2% in March, the first drop in 3 months. Meanwhile, income growth slipped 0.3%, which is worse than an analyst expected, but the number of new applicants for unemployment benefits dropped unexpectedly last week to 631,000 new applicants. Chrysler is expected to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy today. That's after talks between the federal government and the company's debt holders broke down last night. The Treasury increased its cash offered to the lenders, but several still held. If the bankruptcy does go through, that paves the way for Italian carmaker Fiat to take over the company. Yesterday, Congress gave the okay to President Obama's 2010 budget. It comes in at $3.5 trillion.
The Dow and S&P both closed up more than 2% yesterday. The Dow kicks off at 8186 and the S&P starts trade at 874. So this morning we've been asking for your help, your advice for the unemployed, and give them some tips for job hunting.
My secret to being at work right now in the bad economy is just to be good at what you do. Simple and plain. If you're not good at what you do and they need to trim the fat, guess what? You're out on the streets complaining to NPR like everybody else.
877-8 My Take, my take at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick here with Femi OK. We want to get an update on the H1N1 flu situation. 91 confirmed cases so far here in the U.S., according to the CDC. There are also cases in at least 10 other countries. In Mexico, where the flu is thought to have originated, there are about 2,500 confirmed cases. And Felipe Calderon is the president of Mexico. He's urged millions of Mexicans to stay indoors for the next couple of days until Cinco de Mayo. To get a global perspective on the spread of the H1N1 H1N1, otherwise known as swine flu. We have BBC World Service science reporter Matt McGraw with us from London. Matt, WHO raised the pandemic alert level to phase 5 yesterday. That's out of 6 in their total index. What does that say about the scale and potency of the outbreak so far?
It's a strong signal that this pandemic is imminent, according to the WHO. Not inevitable, but imminent. And they are telling the world, the countries of the world, the people of the world, if you like, that they should be making their preparations, that the virus has spread in some ways, and that if it continues to spread as it's doing, we would be in a pandemic situation in a few days, possibly a week.
Okay, the Mexican government is taking some very strong steps. We mentioned urging people to stay home if they can for 4 days, to stay indoors, restricting public gatherings, asking businesses that aren't essential to stay closed. Those measures sound like a big deal. I mean, they are a big deal. How effective can they hope to be? Is there a hope that on the epidemiologic level that they could actually work?
I think there is, because you're talking about a virus that can be spreadable by people who've got it between 5 and 10 days. Often it's at its most virulent in terms of being spread before you show symptoms. So if you have people either in some form of isolation, essentially that's what they're doing by staying at home, you have a great chance, I suppose, of reducing the amount of transmission that people would put between themselves in the normal course of everyday life.
All right, well, we're just on the tail end of the normal seasonal flu season right now. Does this provide perhaps a reprieve? Is it possible that H1N1 will go on the wane here, that we might get a little bit lucky just because of the seasons and then have to deal with it next fall?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it is true. The scientists I've spoken to have said, well, we're lucky in many respects because it is coming at this time. You know, flu viruses don't like sunlight. They don't like UV, so they tend to get to diminish in the summertime in both the north and southern hemispheres. But the converse of that, of course, is that in the southern hemisphere, they're coming into flu season just when this is emerging. So we may end up with a mild version of this virus. Nobody's quite sure yet, but there is always that worry that, like various viruses have happened before, they could come in waves. You could get a mild wave to start with, and then in 6 months' time in the autumn in the northern hemisphere, something far more deadly.
And then in the meantime, of course, there's the prospect of making a vaccine. What are the prospects of vaccines? Normally take about 6 months to get online. They've been trying to get some faster ways to make vaccines. Is there any hope of getting something online quicker than the normal 6 months it takes to grow a new vaccine?
I think everybody is working with that figure, basically, and I think that's what they will work with. There are a couple of different methods that could possibly speed up the process, but the question is the World Health Organization going to risk an untried technology to develop a vaccine for the world, or are they going to go with the tried and tested method? I think they'll go with the tried and tested method, and that will take 4 to 6 months.
Right. They've been trying for years to get new technologies that will ramp up vaccine quicker. They might not get it in time for this particular outbreak. Matt McGraw, BBC science reporter for BBC World Service, thanks for joining us, giving us an update on the current situation with H1N1, otherwise known as the swine flu. Femi.
Thanks, Tal. President Barack Obama marked his first 100 days in office with a primetime news conference. It was the third of his presidency and the first not dominated by the recession. But there are now other threats on the president's mind. We are joined this morning by Jay Newton-Small. She's the Washington reporter for Time magazine. Jay, of course, the president started his press conference speaking about swine flu. I wondered, did his remarks actually comfort you?
Well, no, and that was the point, is that they're meant to scare you a little bit. I heard from administration officials that he really wanted people to be a little bit, wary, like, oh my God, I didn't realize it was that serious, because, it's better to err on the side of caution than to sort of say, no, it's okay, everything's okay, just keep going about your business, and if you really do not feel well, stay home from work. If your kids aren't feeling well, keep them home from school. Don't get on an airplane and try not to spread this thing. I think he did that. He wanted to make sure that people were a little bit freaked out by it.
Also, one reporter put the question to him about how about closing the border to Mexico. Jay, have a listen to his response here.
At this point, they have not recommended a border closing. From their perspective, it would be akin to closing the barn door after the horses are out, because we already have cases here in the United States. We have ramped up screening efforts, as well as made sure that additional supplies are there on the border so that we can prepare in the eventuality that we have to do more than we're doing currently.
Jay, did you get any sense the president knows more than he's actually sharing with the public?
I'm sure that the president knows more than he's sharing with the public. He is the president, after all, and gets lots of briefings that we don't get. But there, I mean, look, we even reported in the news, you had kids who fell sick because they were visiting Disney World in Orlando and spread it there. So just because you close the border now, I mean, we've had tons of Mexicans that have come into the country since the beginning of this illness. We have lots of Americans that have gone to Mexico. In terms of trade, it would be catastrophic. I think at this point we've got so many cases, more than 90 or 100 cases in the U.S. already. He's right. It would be sort of closing the barn door after the horse has already gotten out. You're not going to prevent it from spreading to the U.S.
During his speech last night, the president also actually allotted a certain amount of money as well to tackling swine flu. Have a listen to this.
That's why I asked for an additional $1.5 billion so that we can make sure that everything is in place should a worst-case scenario play out.
And Todd, you were talking to me this morning about this $1.5 billion. It has a specific relevance, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, they want to use it. I was in a hearing the other day where Congress, members of Congress in the Senate first brought this money up. They tried to get some of this money in the stimulus, but they want it for antiviral drugs like Tamiflu to ramp up local and state stockpiles of those drugs, to hire public health workers, to get masks, basic equipment, all of the really, really basic things aside from hand washing that really help spread, help stop the spread of any kind of flu pandemic, including H1N1. Jay, the president was really quick to jump on this $1.5 billion. Looks like it's going in the war supplemental that's coming up, right? Emergency funding?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's two things about this. One is that, you know, the president was very quick to acknowledge that President Bush's preparedness plans for this stuff, which were put in place after the avian flu / SARS scare, were excellent. And in fact, they've been using the Bush plan and it's been working really well. At the same time, there were a lot of Democrats on the Hill who were also sort of saying, look, we had $900 million in the stimulus bill for pandemic flu preparations, which the Republicans took out. And now we're going to get $1.5 billion, which we'll put in the war stuff. This is an example of why the stimulus is so important. It's an example of how the money could potentially be spent out a lot quicker than you would imagine.
All right. Well, Jay, the other day in the subcommittee hearing, when I was in there, the hearing was going on with Senator Tom Harkin, who was asking the money and talking to the public health officials. And then another senator walked into the room and sat on the Democratic side of the aisle for the very first time in a Senate career. And believe me, everyone in the room noticed. It was Arlen Specter, and he had just announced about an hour before that he was switching parties. And he came into that subcommittee. He used to be ranking Republican on that subcommittee. And he sat down on the Democratic side of the aisle, and everybody tittered and shuffled when he did it. So Arlen Specter's joining the Democrats. You like my segue? I just segued right into this. Is the Republican
Nicely done.
Thank you. Is the Republican Party now in desperate straits now that Arlen Specter has deserted them? He seems to think that they are in dire straits.
Well, certainly the Republicans have, they woke up yesterday morning and were sounding the alarm. Oh my God, 60 votes. There's going to be no checks and balances, rampant Democratic control. And Obama was right. And, he struck a much more calmer tone and sort of said, look, it's not always going to be 60 votes that easily. And I think he's right. Look, there's a lot of Democrats that he has a problem bringing on board in the Senate for some of these really big ticket items like health care reform, like energy reform. But where it will make a difference very quickly and very easily is a lot of these procedural votes, which you and I have both seen this in the last 2 years, where there's been 158 motions for cloture filed. Not all of them have gone through, but it's just a lot of gumming up the works.
That means delay. Motions for cloture just means delay, right?
Exactly. Well, it's to overcome a filibuster. Right. It takes 60 votes to overcome it, and they file it for everything from, like, moving on to talk about this amendment. No, we don't want to talk about this amendment. We want to keep talking about the other amendment, which for no particular reason or for whatever reason they want to slow things down. And it basically strips them of the ability to slow things down the way they have in the last 2 years, and so it'll fast-track a lot of stuff.
That's Jay Newton Small, Washington reporter for Time Magazine. Jay, thanks for talking with us this morning. And an old friend of Todd Zwillick. You go way back.
Way back on Capitol Hill.
Excellent stuff. So this morning we are talking about unemployment and your tips for the unemployed, trying to help them get a job. Let's get personal here. Your suggestions, business cards, nepotism, simplify your resume. 1-877-8-MY-TAKE is our telephone number, or send us an email. Todd will read it out at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Your tips for the unemployed. Let's get personal.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I do not know what you are drinking this morning, but you are truly inspired, Takeaway listeners. This is Femi O'Kane, Todd Zwillick taking care of you this morning. We asked you for your tips for job hunting, and you came up with tons of them. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Christy Ash, and I'm calling from the Detroit metro area. It's always best to take whatever you can, even if it's flipping burgers somewhere, because it's easier to find a job if you already have a job. It shows that you want to work.
877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also go to our website, thetakeaway.org, to listen to our interview with job expert Marcy Alberher for more tips on finding jobs. Todd.
All right, Femi. Entertainment companies now are ratcheting up the pressure on governments to stop people from downloading movies and music and books illegally on the internet, things like that. Well, here come the French. They're going further. They want to consider a law that would punish internet users for illegal downloads by cutting off their internet service.
That's harsh.
Well, here comes the EU telling France that cutting off internet service violates people's human rights. Let's talk to Siva Vaidyanathan. He's associate professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. He's our resident technology expert. Siva, is internet access a basic human right that can't be taken away?
No, you know, Europe's pretty funny. I mean, you know, just even using a term like that, it's just so weird to the American ear. Really, look, you know, I mean, how can it be a basic human right when a lot fewer than half of all humans have ever experienced the internet? I mean, it seems kind of absurd, but and it kind of is. I mean, you know, both proposals miss the mark, essentially. And you have to remember also, the European Parliament can pass all the resolutions in the world, and it doesn't actually have the force of law. The European Council has to approve what the Parliament does, and the European Council right now is kind of run by President Sarkozy in France, who's the main instigator of this policy proposal that hasn't passed the French legislature either, the French Parliament either.
Well, what exactly is Sarkozy proposing now? Taking away internet, but what are the parameters of this? What do you have to do?
It means basically there'll be three strikes you're out. If an internet service provider, like, you know, the company that provides you your high speed internet at home, senses that you have downloaded or uploaded illegal files, the first step is a warning letter. The second step is something more than a warning letter. It's really unclear. But the second step, the third step is they cancel your account. Right. Of course, this is so easy to route around. I mean, this whole proposal is based on the sort of principle, the same principle that the French used before World War II with the Maginot Line, right? This idea that you would build this elaborate structure that the Panzer tank divisions just routed right around, and that's exactly what people do. So it's equivalent to like the missile defense proposals in this country or waterboarding, right? Things that have absolutely no real effect on the world but make you feel so much better for doing them. Right?
Okay, so what you're saying is even if France did pass a law like this and you could get your internet privileges revoked for illegal downloads, people are smart enough to just set up false IP addresses and find ways to cloak their computers, right?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, they'd use proxy servers, they'd use strong encryption.
And it's easy, right? It's relatively easy.
It's so easy. That's the thing. All of these laws and technologies that have been rolled out over the last 10 years to try to limit this sort of behavior have been the sort of thing that become annoying to casual users of the internet who aren't the big problem. But the people who actually care deeply about downloading, you know, an entire season of Lost are going to figure out the 2-3 steps they need to be able to do it without any interference. You know, plus, look, all you have to do is take your laptop to a public Wi-Fi hub somewhere in France. Now, of course, their response, the French response, the Sarkozy's government's response to that is that the Wi-Fi, public Wi-Fi sites are actually going to be very limited in what they can sell, what they can distribute, what sort of sites you can reach, and there actually will be a whitelist of approved sites. They say, that public Wi-Fi sites public Wi-Fi areas will let you get to, which sounds so much like the People's Republic of China.
Okay, so it's all well and good. It's actually kind of fun to point at the folly of the French on this and Maginot lines and missile defense and everything else. But here in the United States, let's be honest, the Motion Picture Association and the recording industry. I think I read a number. They claim to lose $20 billion a year in sales to illegal downloads. I don't know if I buy that number or not, but even if it's in the right order of magnitude, those are fighting words. That's fighting money. So what's going to happen here in this country?
It is if it were real money. You know, that's the thing. Like, that number is based on rough addition that occurs or multiplication that occurs, you know, by some weird magician in their building. But basically, look, one of the things we have figured out over the last 10 years is that there's no zero sum when it comes to cultural products. So if, in fact, these were lost sales never made, sales that never would be made, then iTunes never would have taken off, that we would be selling zero CDs as opposed to millions of CDs, certainly fewer than we used to. We'd be selling zero DVDs as opposed to millions of DVDs. So, in fact, there is no simple addition and subtraction because of this sort of behavior. And everyone kind of gets that. I mean, Steve Jobs got it, which is why we have iTunes. iTunes competes with free music, and it does so very successfully by providing a reasonably priced, dependable service that's easy to use and puts very low limitations on users. So, right. You know, that's the sort of thing some people have figured out.
Right. Those things we call digital rights management would seem to come and go. I'm sure we'll have time to talk about DRM in the future. Siva Vaidyanathan is Associate Professor of Media Studies and Law at the University of Virginia. He's also author of Copyrights and Copy Wrongs. He was here to talk about the folly of the French and what might happen as they try to punish illegal downloads. Well, Richard Hake is here with the headlines now.
And Todd, there are nearly 2,500 suspected cases of swine flu in Mexico. Mexican President Felipe Calderon is asking the 107 million citizens to stay inside for the next 5 days, from May 1st through May 5th. May 5th, of course, is Cinco de Mayo, a national holiday in Mexico. Here in the U.S., about 140 schools in Texas are closed. Alabama officials have also canceled classes for more than 30,000 students in one county because of two suspected flu cases there. In other stories, on Capitol Hill, Congress approved President Obama's 2010 budget plans to the tune of $3.5 trillion. Today, Congress will take on two bills that could help consumers. The House votes on one that would limit the power credit card companies have to unexpectedly raise the rates. That's expected to pass, but a Senate bill may not pass so easily. The Senate takes on legislation that would give mortgage relief to homeowners. A coalition of women's activist groups in Kenya say its members will withhold sex from their partners for a week to protest infighting within the national government. Here's Patricia Nioandi of the group Federation of Kenyan Women Lawyers.
It's time for us to say, what can we really sacrifice as a statement to show that our country means so much for us? And what we said is that sex is a cross-cutting issue.
Some organizations say they also plan to pay prostitutes to join the strike. Relations between Kenya's coalition government partners have become increasingly testy of late. The women's groups say they want to avoid civil violence.
That get their
story
attention.
Has danger written all over it.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick here with Femi Okeh. Folks, millions of your neighbors and friends out there are looking for a job. Of course, in this economy, that's a lot easier to say than it is to do. So we need your help. Your friends, your family, your community needs your help. What's your own tip for job hunting that can give your friends and family a leg up?
This is Jen Rood from Detroit, Michigan, and my advice for people looking for a job is to email your resume to every single person you know. That's the only way that I got my last two jobs. My most recent job, I just started on Monday, and I had been unemployed for a month last year. I was unemployed for 5 months, and ultimately my job came to me by a friend.
Okay, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi.
Thanks, Todd. Now, do you remember all of that public outrage directed at bailed-out banks that gave their employees bonuses?
It isn't right. It just simply isn't right when there is a reward, a spelled-out in advance reward for those who will take undue risk. When they fail, they get a bonus. The taxpayer gets the bill.
That was Nancy Pelosi in March of this year, but Swiss bank Credit Suisse has found a very creative solution to the bonus-paying problem. Pay part of your employees' bonuses in toxic assets. So toxic assets are all of those bad loans that the banks have made. Jesse Eisinger is a financial writer who has worked at the Wall Street Journal and Portfolio. So Jesse, just imagine that I work for Credit Suisse for a moment and I'm getting paid toxic assets as my bonus. What do I actually get?
What you get is an interest in complex security, all these securities that we've heard about. And really what you're doing is just getting income stream from a bunch of loans that Credit Suisse has made. And in fact, you have helped make those loans. And so you're eating what you cooked, or as I like to say, you're eating your own garbage.
Right. Okay. So does that mean that I actually have to pay out any money because I have toxic assets? Do I lose money?
No. What happens is you get an interest in a security. So you've gotten a bonus, and you've gotten a bonus half in cash as you normally did. And instead of stock, this time you got an interest in a loan, in a fixed income security, and you get an interest payment. And then if the value goes up, you get part of that as well.
Ah, it's, I get it. Okay, light bulb moment.
And so what's in it for Credit Suisse? Do they get to unload these toxic assets off their books that they're giving to employees?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So they get two benefits from this. They get a little nice publicity from financial writers like me who praise them. And then they also got to move the toxic assets off the books. And the central problem with the banking system globally, as we know, is that the banks made collectively way too many bad loans to commercial real estate, to residential real estate, to companies that can't afford to pay them back, and they're having to take write-downs. So Credit Suisse took a write-down on this collection of loans and gave portions to the employees.
Okay, so the other thing we know about this global crisis, though, is that nobody knows what toxic assets are worth. And what the market wants to pay for them, the banks won't accept. So if you're an employee who just got a bonus in toxic assets, do you have any clue what it's worth, if anything?
That's exactly the crux of the whole issue. And this transaction lends a lot of insight into that, because what happened is they priced these at 65 cents on the dollar. And essentially, they said all these bundles of loans and we've taken from all over the world, and we've taken commercial real estate, and we've taken loans to companies. We're going to price them at 65 cents on the dollar. And that sheds a lot of light on what they may be worth, what the banks really think that they're worth when they're trying to sell them in the Geithner plan that we've heard so much about. Maybe they're worth 65 cents on the dollar. We don't really know, but at least the banks think that Credit Suisse thinks that this kind of loan is worth this to the employees. Now, residential real estate securities are going for much less now, sometimes 20 or 30 cents on the dollar. So this is a lot higher than those really toxic assets. There are there are degrees of toxic assets.
Do you think they were exaggerating how much they were worth just to make their employees feel a little better, perhaps?
Well, it presented this interesting negotiation, because the employees now are pitted against the employer. The employees want them to be marked down as low as possible so that they're paying essentially the lowest price, and then they get the appreciation. The employer has the interest of paying them in a higher price. So if they got them for 25 cents on the dollar, they'd obviously have more upside than if they got them at 90 cents on the dollar. And they ended up with this compromise, and they tried to be disinterested about how they arrived at it. We'll see if it's too optimistic or not. It'll take about 5 years to play out.
Has this ever been done before, Jesse?
No, the banks haven't really faced this problem in this kind of scale before. So they don't have this kind of toxic – they haven't had this toxic asset problem before. And Credit Suisse is the first to do this. And to my knowledge, they're the only ones to do this. The problem with Pay, as Nancy Pelosi pointed out, is that all the bankers were incentivized to solely perform on a short-term basis. They had extraordinary myopia. They only were paid on the basis of producing loans rather than how the loans performed. This goes to the heart of solving that problem, but it won't really solve it because no bank has any interest in acting unilaterally. And, you know, Credit Suisse, they did this. This is a one-time deal. It's very good that they've done this, but no bank is going to really sort of jump into this and give their employees less money or money in difficult-to-price assets again. And that's why I think that Pay should really be regulated.
Jesse Eisinger, he's a financial writer who's worked at the Wall Street Journal and Portfolio Magazine. Jesse, I understood everything you said for the entire 5 minutes. Congratulations, you're brilliant. And now we head to the news with Richard Haig.
And Femi, good morning. There are nearly 2,500 suspected cases of swine flu in Mexico. The president there is asking the 107 million citizens to stay inside for the next 5 days. Here in the United States, you can tell people are taking this seriously. Walgreens spokesperson Timothy Washington says the demand for face masks and hand sanitizers is way up.
We have seen a significant increase in demand, primarily in the Texas markets, Southern California, and even Illinois, primarily in the Chicagoland area, largely in Mexican-American communities.
California and New York have the most confirmed cases in the United States. In Mexico, police have arrested a suspected drug boss accused of being a kingpin in one of the most notorious drug gangs there. The gang is called Los Zetas. Our partner, the BBC, says the gang is made up of former hitmen and former police officers. They say the gang operates in drug and human trafficking and prostitution rings. Sri Lanka's president has ruled out the possibility of a ceasefire in the fight against Tamil Tiger rebels. The leaders there say they will not surrender, even though the government has cornered them in the north of the island. The Tamil Tigers are fighting for a separate ethnic state. And Bank of America's shareholders stripped Ken Lewis of his chairman title yesterday. Shareholders voted to split his leadership position in a contentious annual meeting.
Thank you very much, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Femi Okay. Today is the latest stage in India's elections and the world's largest democracy votes over a period of about a month. Our partners, the BBC, have been riding a very special elections train across India during the election season. Today, the train reached the city of Mumbai, which is where I spoke with the BBC's India correspondent, Tinku Ray, earlier on this morning. And when we spoke, I asked Tinku to give us a snapshot of Mumbai on election day.
Well, it's a very muggy day, I can tell you that much. I've been out and about this morning, Femi, just to sort of, you know, gauge the kind of temperature of people. Are they coming out to vote or not? I went out into South Mumbai, which is where many of our listeners might remember there were the horrific attacks that happened late last year, in which 10 gunmen held the city to siege. And this is a, you know, part of the city where it's very affluent, very middle class, well-off families. And usually they've been pretty lazy in their voting, but it seems like it was pretty good this morning. There were a lot of people out at the booths. They were, you know, giving their votes, and they were very happy to talk as well.
It's interesting for us to talk about Mumbai because 10 months ago it was in the news all the time. Are the terrorist attacks, have they had any impact on the way people are voting today?
I think they are in some places, like I mentioned here in South Mumbai, where the attacks actually took place. Some of the people have been that I talked to, you know, said that the attacks were an issue for them, that they're, you know, they want more security in their lives, they want the government to do more to make the place safer for them. And so it's actually spurred on some people to come out and vote, people who have never voted before. There was one man who's 65 years old, and he said, oh, I'm a first-time voter. And I said, you're 65, how can you be a first-time voter? And he said, well, I'm fed up. I'm fed up of how our government's running the country, and I really want to see a change.
The BBC are using a really interesting vehicle to get around India. It's a big place, so I can understand why they might want to take a train around India. How does that help in terms of getting to see the electorate picking up on their opinions?
Well, as you mentioned, it is a big country. It's almost the size of a continent. And when you think about traveling in India, you think of the train. That's the vehicle that the masses use. It's the cheapest way to get around. It's not very quick, I must admit. I mean, it can take, you know, sometimes 30 hours to get from one point to another, as we've been noticing. But it's a good way, I think, for us. There's about 40 journalists on the train to, you know, sort of go from point to point. And then once we get off the train, go out into the streets, go out into the countryside, into the cities, and just talk to people and see what, you know, just get some really good stories and get some idea about what's concerning them and what they're worried about. So it's been very, very educational, I could say.
Something that caught our eye on the takeaway yesterday was the number of candidates in the national elections who are actually criminals. How does that work? How is that even possible?
Well, they're not criminals in the real sense, Femi, because they're facing criminal charges, but they haven't actually been convicted of any charges. And the Indian Constitution allows anyone to stand for election as long as you're not convicted. So, I mean, there are all these thousands of candidates who are up for election who are facing various charges, and some of them are very serious. We're talking about murder, arson, corruption, and all kinds of other issues.
That was the BBC's Tinku Ray. She's their India correspondent reporting from Mumbai, with the crows from Mumbai as well. You can also go to thetakeaway.org to follow the BBC train online.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's Femi OK and Todd Zwillig looking after you today. John Hockenberry is off. We've been asking you this morning about your tips to help people find jobs, and you've come up with some good ones.
My name is Max from Brooklyn, and I think it's a great idea to call people even if you don't think they're hiring, because you don't really know what's in the works for a certain company. For example, I was hired at a job that actually had just opened up a new branch but hadn't publicized it at all. So it never hurts if you think there's an organization or company for which you would be perfect to just make a contact with them.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can also go to our website at thetakeaway.org to listen to our interview with job expert Marcy Alberher for more tips on finding jobs. Meanwhile, we get the latest news about swine flu from Richard Hake at the news desk.
And Femi, good morning. Airlines are encouraging passengers not to let worries about the swine flu keep them from traveling. Here's Tim Smith of American Airlines.
We fly approximately 250,000 people every day. So far, we've not had one ill person on our flights be tested positive for swine flu.
There are 91 confirmed cases of swine flu here in the United States. In any event, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano says it's too late to actually contain the virus.
This virus is already in the United States, so any kind of containment theory that you've got to keep it out of the United States is really moot at this time.
The World Health Organization has raised the pandemic alert level to 5 out of 6. That's characterized by human-to-human spread of the virus into at least 2 countries in one region. Those countries are the U.S. and Mexico. The Obama administration says Chrysler will file for bankruptcy protection after talks broke down with a small group of the company's creditors. The government had long hoped to stave off bankruptcy for Chrysler, but negotiations between the Treasury Department and Chrysler's lenders broke down last night. However, bankruptcy doesn't mean Chrysler will shut down. It's expected to sign a partnership with the Italian company Fiat as part of its restructuring plan. President Obama is expected to address concerns over the nation's auto sector at noon. Yesterday, Congress gave the okay to the president's 2010 budget. It comes in at $3.5 trillion. And just in from the Commerce Department, consumer spending fell in March for the first time in 3 months, and incomes for Americans dropped for a second straight month. Those are some of the stories this morning.
All right, Richard, thank you. Well, President Obama last night announced the war supplemental for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan will also include $1.5 billion to combat swine flu in this country. Richard, as you mentioned, we have 91 confirmed cases of H1N1 in this country so far, according to CDC. But what if we could have prevented this outbreak from happening before it even got out? What if it could have been prevented in the first place? Epidemiologist and virus hunter Nathan Wolf argues in an op-ed in this morning's New York Times that we could have done just that. Nathan Wolf joins us from Atlanta right now. He's director of the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative and a visiting professor in human biology at Stanford University. Nathan, why do you think we could have detected this virus and stopped it before it started to spread?
This is a virus like many others. The majority of the important infectious diseases in our history and the diseases that are outbreaks, they all come from animals.
Right.
You could name a disease and I would tell you, you know, where we think it came from, but HIV, SARS, Ebola, so-called bird flu, the H5N1 virus, these are all animal viruses that entered into humans. And basically what we do is we work with people who are highly exposed to animals throughout the world, and we monitor them over time. We collect specimens from them, from the animals that they're exposed to. And what we've demonstrated in places like Central Africa is we can actually catch the moment at which these viruses enter into human populations. That gives us a huge leg up because we can characterize the virus, we can understand its immunological and genetic signatures, we can work to try to contain the virus early before it gets to major cities and spreads around the world, help to develop diagnostics and vaccines. So this swine flu is not an anomaly. We're sort of responding to it like it's something brand new, but really it's part of this long-term history that we have with viruses, which is very much accelerating as we become interconnected as a global population because of planes, trains, and automobiles that
right.
really sort of make us one village.
With all of the hundreds of millions of people who work in agriculture and work in close proximity to animals around sort of the tropical zones of the earth where most flu originates, and with all of probably the billions of animals that they're surrounded by, you could do this kind of surveillance, but isn't it the case that there are so many opportunities for virus to jump that it would get by your nets even if you had 100 or 200 or 1,000 epidemiologists up close and personal?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, one of the things that is sort of propels our thinking is that a smaller percentage of the Earth's human population is mostly in touch with these animals increasingly. So as we go by in time, people become more and more specialized and jobs become more and more specialized. So we think that a smaller percentage of the world's population is accountable for most of the interaction with animals. That gives us some hope of being able to cover them. But our monitoring system sort of goes beyond the animal interface. I mean, that will give us many of the viruses that are there. But we also work in regional centers in these sort of viral hotspots around the world to be able to see what's going on in those regional centers. So you have to have a combined package. But we definitely feel like we need to be moving towards prediction of these things.
All right. Well, Nathan, in addition to prediction, there's also prevention in the clinical sense. And since we're talking about this, we've been emphasizing all morning the very basic advice that people can take upon themselves: washing their hands, being vigilant, staying home from work if they're sick. And while we're talking about it, I want to just hit that point again, and I I want you to listen to something, some advice we got from a listener, Mariah, who's a nurse, who has her own advice from the front lines about how to prevent the spread of any flu virus, including H1N1.
I'm a public health nurse, and I finally heard what I think is the most important thing about this flu epidemic, whatever it is to cough into your elbow. It is important not to sneeze into your hands and then wipe your hands places. It defeats the whole purpose, and sneezing into your elbow is key.
All right. We just wanted to hit that point real quickly, if we could, since we're talking about flu, make sure that people know just how easy it is to help themselves and their families prevent getting sick. So, Nathan, on the front lines in the tropical zones to spot viruses early and prevent them from spreading, what do you need? Do you need money? Do you need political will? What is it?
Well, there's starting to be sort of a front line of activity to move towards prevention. This is sort of like where cardiology was in the 50s, where it was mostly dealing with heart attacks, but people starting to recognize what's going on. Organizations like USAID are increasingly putting funding into pandemic prevention, but we think really much more is needed. Prevention of pandemics needs to be a part of the portfolio of all of the major biomedical research funders, including groups like NIH and CDC, which obviously has started to do some of this, WHO. We need to all these organizations, a percentage of their portfolio needs to be focused on thinking about not just our own effort, which is sort of the human-animal interface, but work like modeling and organizations like HealthMap. And certainly some of the philanthropies like Google.org and the Skoll Foundation have really sort of started to lead this effort. But I think that there's a lot of partners that we could use in really trying to prevent these things. These are common phenomena, and they will continue to occur. Swine flu is not a one-off. It's right. Part of a steady trend. Viruses like this will continue to enter into the human population, and we need to be pushing forward efforts like ours at the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative, but also similar kinds of efforts elsewhere, and really make this a main effort. An ounce of prevention really is worth a pound of cure.
Nathan Wolf is director of the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative and visiting professor in human biology at Stanford University. He's one of the people on the front lines trying to predict and head off flu viruses before they can get out into the human population. You can read his op-ed in today's New York Times, Femi.
So we've been asking you this morning for your tips on job hunting. So what can the unemployed do to get help, and how can you help them? We've had one caller come all in from New York.
Hello, this is Nigel from New York, and I was sitting around with a bunch of my mates, and we were saying, you know, the best thing you can do if you're unemployed is to listen to this program on public radio called The Takeaway, and especially Femi OK. She has all kinds of fabulous tips, and I think it's really one of the best things you could possibly do. This is Nigel in New York. Thank you.
I think Nigel's a little fishy.
Nigel in New York. Could be John Hockenberry on his way to somewhere else. Good morning, John. Good morning, all. And here is your real takeaway about the swine flu from the BBC science reporter, Mac McGrath.
We may end up with a mild version of this virus. Nobody's quite sure yet, but there is always that worry that, like various viruses have happened before, they could come in waves. You could get a mild wave to start with, and then in 6 months' time in the autumn in the Northern Hemisphere, something far more deadly.
And if you've missed any of our show, you can catch up online, or you can also catch up on iTunes as well.
I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Femi OK, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.